From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. For all of the right-wing criticism about cancel culture on the left, there is one issue that is so sacrosanct that both conservative and liberal institutions will engage in silencing tactics, and that is the issue of Israel. When popular columnist and writer Nathan Robinson recently on Twitter posted a joke about US military aid to Israel, a joke that is grounded in reality, he was fired by the solidly left-of-center paper, The Guardian, where he had been writing for several years. Nathan Robinson is editor of Current Affairs, author of Why You Should Be a Socialist, which is just out in paperback. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Republic, The Nation, and elsewhere. Welcome to the program, Nathan.
Hello, nice to be with you.
So I know that, of course, you are well aware, even before your own firing, that any criticism of the state of Israel has often been not tolerated, especially in mainstream spaces. But the joke that you made, and we'll put up the tweet on screen for our TV audience, I'll read it out for our radio audience. You said, did you know that the U.S. Congress is not actually permitted to authorize any new spending unless a portion of it is directed toward buying weapons for Israel? It's the law. Obviously, tongue-in-cheek, but grounded in, you were being sarcastic. What was the response before The Guardian even fired you?
Yes, and it's just notable that I did include, there's a second tweet that says, by the way, not a real law, in case you're fooled, don't be, just joking. Right? So, and as soon as I tweeted that, I got an email from the editor-in-chief of The Guardian, a man that I had only interacted with once before, who essentially suggested that it was anti-Semitic. And it was very clear from his tone that my job was in jeopardy. So I took it down because I was very worried, right? And obviously that didn't make a difference. I knew, of course, even before this, that this was a touchy subject. I've written before about the suppression of criticism of Israel and the way that people's jobs can be on the line if they say the wrong thing. Obviously, I had no idea that where exactly the line was, and you don't really find out where it is until you've crossed it, and then someone comes to you with an email that says, "By the way, this is the line, you've crossed it, you're out."
The Guardian is not a even centrist publication, forget about right wing. I mean, certainly there are centrist elements and parts to it, but it is known as a liberal, pretty solidly liberal publication. And certainly there is criticism of Israel that has been published in The Guardian. What is the basis for claiming anti-Semitism when you simply joked that the U.S. basically, you know, gives military aid to Israel any chance it gets?
Yeah, so there's a common argument that is used by defenders of Israel, which is that if you single out Israel for criticism, you are singling out, and in fact, my editor said, singling out the only Jewish state. You know, essentially, why pick on Israel? The explanation, the presumed explanation being that you have some kind of inner prejudice. Now, it's worth noting the reason why I think that doesn't apply is because I am not the one who singled out Israel. The United States has singled out Israel for support for many, many years. It's the single largest cumulative recipient of military aid by the United States. U.S. politicians constantly talk about how there's a special relationship with Israel. So I'm pointing out that special relationship that U.S. politicians say exists. I am not uniquely fixated on Israel as a state that I want to criticize more than I criticize other states, in which case, you know, you might wonder if I had some kind of inner bigotry. But as you say, The Guardian is not a reactionary conservative paper. The Guardian is a center-left paper. And that's, in fact, why my firing is so alarming, because, you know, this is a publication that does publish criticisms of Israel, but it's quite clear that they are very, very sensitive to any perception that they could be unfair to Israel, or if charges of anti-Semitism are made, you know, regardless of whether they're grounded or not, they are willing to, as you know, sort of purge the staff to make sure that they don't fall afoul of these kinds of allegations.
Now, if the U.S., and of course the U.S. gives military aid to many nations, if Israel was just one of many nations that the U.S. gave aid to and it fell somewhere, you know, maybe in the top 10 and you were singling out Israel, maybe that criticism might be valid. But you point out in your article in Current Affairs, after you were fired, you wrote how the media cracks down on critics of Israel. You point out that the U.S. aid to Israel is by far the largest. Israel is the number one recipient of U.S. military aid, right? So as you said, U.S. is singling it out.
It was for a long time. It's been surpassed in the last couple of years by Afghanistan, I think, but it is still the largest cumulative recipient. They've received more in military aid, and it's still, you know, very high. It's number sort of two or three. I think it's true that we have to talk about other states that the United States aids. I mean, we publish in my magazine, Current Affairs, we talk about assistance of Saudi Arabia, and essentially, like, the reason to criticize Israel and the United States' relationship with it is because the U.S. offers support to a number of allies who are useful for our country's strategic interests, but never and chooses to look the other way when those countries abuse human rights or violate international law, as both Saudi Arabia and Israel do.
And in fact, that is a big part of the issue. And Egypt as well, which is a big recipient of aid, which unfortunately the Biden administration has now continued that in spite of the fact that there is a very repressive dictatorship in Egypt. What these countries do with U.S. military aid matters. And of course, Israel has an absolutely lengthy and sordid history of using the U.S. military aid and the weapons that are buys from the U.S. as part of its tactics of repression against Palestinians. That is part of the story, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I think that's the most important part of the story here, right? Which is, it's not about me as a person who had a cushy columnist position. I deserve the freedom to tweet whatever I want. What it is there's a particular issue that needs to be discussed, which is that all this assistance the United States gives to Israel is used in part to create what, and this is not my phrasing, this is there was a report from B'Tselem, Israel's leading human rights organization, just this year, that has said that it's now undeniable that Israel is an apartheid state. And the reason it's an apartheid state is quite simple, because Israel exerts complete domination and control over the occupied territories, West Bank and Gaza, and yet doesn't provide equal rights for Palestinian people. And that's straightforward, right? So that's what the United States is condoning and assisting with this aid. And so when we can't talk about that, we can't talk about our country's role in facilitating what is essentially an international crime.
And in fact, being the only Jewish state in the world doesn't exempt Israel from having to observe human rights standards. In fact, the very basis of the fact that it is an ethno state is part of the problem. But we're all, you know, the media has been cowed into not focusing on that, which of course has massive consequences for Palestinians. But you pointed out an interesting thing, which is that there are so many and growing numbers of Jewish and Jewish Israeli and Jewish American critics of the state of Israel.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true that the reason for that is partially because Israel claims to speak for the community of Jewish people, and many people who are Jewish object to having their names invoked to justify the acts of the Israeli government. One of the most vociferous critics of the conduct of Israel, Norman Finkelstein, his parents were Holocaust survivors. They were at Auschwitz, and most of his family perished in the Holocaust. And part of his anger towards the conduct of Israel very clearly comes from seeing, you know, the suffering and what he calls the martyrdom of his people used to justify acts that he considers oppressive and wrong. And so, yes, in both, in Israel, the leading human rights organizations are comprised of Jewish people who object to the way that their Jewish values are being perverted and exploited and distorted. And the same is true in the United States, where leading critics, people in If Not Now, people in the BDS movement, because this is because Israel does claim to speak on behalf of Jewish people.
You, in your current affairs piece that you published in response to your firing, published in full the email that was sent to you by the chief editor of The Guardian, even though that email was marked private and confidential. Why was it marked private and confidential, you think?
Well, it was marked private and confidential because he didn't want anyone to know that he had told me what he told me. Now, I observe very strongly my agreements with people to keep something private. But if you email someone and say this email is private, but they haven't agreed to your terms, they are under no obligation to keep it private just because you'd prefer they not tell anyone. And I thought it was very important that people understand that what was happening here, it was not a cancel culture mob coming for me. It was quiet. Hmm. It was under the table. He didn't want anyone to know. In fact, you see in that email, what he says is you are free to tweet what you want. So he wanted to maintain the public position that columnists are free to speak their mind on this issue, but the private position, the confidential position, that actually we are going to police their tweets and we are going to make sure they don't get out of line.
Why did he fire you even after you deleted your tweet, though?
I think I don't know. I think because I also posed, you can see in there the sort of groveling email I sent him in reply, where he said, and he suggests sort of we're all good. I suspect that any hint, any whiff of the possibility that you could have an anti-Semitic columnist or someone branded that way or someone controversial is just not worth taking. Remember, columnists are expendable at publications like The Guardian, right? We don't have contracts. And in fact, one of the things The Guardian pointed out in its statement was they said, I wasn't really fired because columnists don't have job security through a contract, right? So for him, there's no benefit. There are 1,000 people who'd love to be Guardian columnists. It's a very prestigious position. There is no reason whatsoever to keep me around. So better to sort of kick people out the door if they cause even a hint of a PR.
We know that there have been, you are now part of a growing number of people who have been canceled, if you will, over even the merest hint of criticism of Israel. Mark Lamont Hill, who you point out in your article, was a CNN commentator, lost his position because of that. And you know, there have been especially people in academia who've lost positions. It's amazing that the defense of First Amendment rights is brought up so often to protect white supremacists, to protect all sorts of conservative positions. And yet when it comes to Israel, you see this sentiment. And then there's the whole other aspect, which is that there is growing, real, actual anti-Semitism on the right among Trump supporters in the Republican Party, which you don't hear nearly enough about.
Yes. So 2 points there. I think you're completely right that it's notable in the discussions about cancel culture that more attention is paid to the career consequences that happen to bigots than to these sorts of cases. And I've long pointed out that it is actually leftist speech that is more suppressed. There's a New York Times article about a Slate podcast host who was fired, who said the N-word. And, you know, there's a whole New York Times article about that. It wasn't a New York Times article about the firing of me, right, which is quiet. So there's this big debate about whether racists can speak while ignoring the ways that politically inconvenient and marginal, what is, you know, sort of marginal views are suppressed, because that's done quietly. So I think that is, I mean, you're absolutely right to note that. that contradiction.
And then, you know, there is this very, very dangerous trend that we're seeing growing attacks, especially over the past 4 years with Trump supporters. This week, there is a hearing on the Capitol riot where you saw Confederate flags and you saw all sorts of incredibly troubling, actually racist things that Republicans are trying to downplay, claiming that it was all Antifa in disguise. And you know, they aren't canceled, not nearly enough as they would like to claim they're being canceled. In fact, you hear right-wingers constantly talking about how they are being silenced, but of course they're still talking and they're still being heard, which gives lie to the claim that they're being silenced, mostly on Fox News.
Yes, I wrote an article once called "Pretty Loud for Being So Silenced," which was about the fact that they all get book deals and they all get, you know, we talk about them incessantly, right? And they make a bunch of money off of it. You know, anti-Semitism is a real and very serious problem, right? I mean, it led to the greatest crime of the 20th century, the Holocaust, and one of the problems with tossing the accusation around lightly and using it to defend the crimes of a foreign government is that it cheapens it. It does become like the boy who cried wolf, which is there are actual wolves. Anti-Semitism is a real thing. We need that term to mean something. We can't have that be used lightly, because when it's used lightly and when it's used cynically for political purposes, then people will stop taking it seriously when it is something very serious and important.
I want to mention, by the way, that the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting published an open letter to the U.S. editor of The Guardian about your firing, a letter that was signed by a numerous well-known figures on the left, even, you know, people who are active on the issue of Israel and Palestine. And I imagine that, you know, I don't know if that's had any effect on The Guardian, which I imagine does enjoy still its reputation among some aspects of the left. Did it have any impact as far as you know?
Not as far as we know so far. I hope, I hope it got to John Mulholland and caused him to think twice. I think the effect, if there was an effect, we're not going to notice it, because what I'm really hoping that my publicizing of this and that open letter do is help to protect other writers at The Guardian. I think if there is public backlash, it is unlikely, very unlikely, to get me my job back. But what it can do is make it so that when other Guardian writers tweet things that John Mulholland, the editor, objects to, he thinks twice about punishing them for it, because he knows that there will be serious backlash and because there's been a very strong expression of disapproval by many respected figures on the left. So that is my hope, because my firing chills speech. Right, it doesn't just affect me. It affects every writer who still has a job and now knows that everything they're saying on this issue is being watched carefully. And that's very, very dangerous, because it means that they're not going to speak freely on something that they need to talk about.
Nathan, I would like to take advantage of the fact that you are on an interview with us and pivot to your book. You've written a book, Why You Should Be a Socialist, which is just out in paperback. Different topic that we're talking about. And this is an issue that, of course, is very much in the news today, because we're seeing in the aftermath of the Texas devastating winter storms, the outages, the blackouts, the water shortages, that Republicans have gone on the offensive, not against deregulation, which was responsible for the outages, but against the Green New Deal, which is not even enacted, especially not in Texas. And people do notice it. How do you, summarize your work on why you should be a socialist in the context of, say, something like Texas and deregulation, where millions of people suffered, people have died?
Yeah. Now, you know, people often mistake socialism for the position that the government should be in charge of everything, right, versus the private sector, which is not what it is. Socialism is about public control. Now, that may be through government institutions, but it's about democratic control, right? So in the case of the power grid in Texas, the question is, do unaccountable corporate titans control the grid, or does it reflect the public policy priorities of the majority of Texans? Now, here's an interesting thing, right? People are becoming more sympathetic to the kind of socialist critiques. We know that millennials have been turning socialist, but it was very interesting in the aftermath of the Texas thing to see that Ted Cruz tweeted out after people started getting these $16,000 electric bills for keeping their lights on during the storm, and which is, of course, the free market at work. It costs a lot to deliver power during the storm, so people get billed for it. And a Ted Cruz, of all people, a very strong defender of free market capitalism, usually said it's outrageous that these profiteers are trying to make all this money. And so we, as socialists, of course, say, welcome, comrade Ted, to the revolution, right? Which is, he is showing that the free market position, the radical free market position that has been so dominant in US politics, is completely untenable because it leads to a place that is completely incompatible with people's basic moral intuitions about how a society ought to be run and in whose interests it ought to be run.
And it's quite remarkable to see those people who will denounce any talk of the Green New Deal, of Medicare for All, when there is a crisis, suddenly discuss, well, of course people shouldn't pay outrageous electricity bills, or in the case of, say, the pandemic, outrageous healthcare bills. Of course, the government should step in. But that argument disappears when we are out of a crisis and when the crises are spread around to an individual level and therefore invisibilized. And it's quite stunningly hypocritical.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the next book that I'm writing right now and trying to finish up is actually called Responding to the Right, Quick Replies to Conservative Arguments. Hmm. And I'm reading a lot of conservative literature. And one of the things that comes up all the time, they all have in defense of price gouging. And they say if you believe in the free market, you have to believe that price gouging is actually good after a disaster because, letting supply and demand work their way is ultimately better than having the government set prices. But then, as you say, during an actual disaster, it becomes evident how sort of morally perverse actual price gouging is, because you see that you see the impact that it has on really desperate people who then have to fork over all of their savings for things that they should be entitled to, like being able to stay warm during a freezing cold storm. And so I think oftentimes conservative ideology, when it runs up against reality, is kind of exposed. When the talk of liberty meets the reality of what it's like to, say, work in an Amazon warehouse, right? And you see how much power a boss has, and you see it doesn't really feel like liberty, even though it meets the sort of Milton Friedman criterion of it. You really see these ideological beliefs kind of fall apart.
And then finally, just to bring our first topic and our second topic together, one of the issues that has not gotten very much attention because the media tends to give special treatment to Israel is that during the pandemic, Israel has been lauded for, doing what governments should be doing, which is making sure that the vaccines for COVID are distributed to its citizens. But of course, it has ensured that those vaccines have gotten to Palestinians extremely late. Only after Israelis got vaccinated, and then just a tiny, tiny drop in the bucket. So far, 22,000 vaccines for something like 2 million people in the Gaza Strip. Israel is praised for taking the swift action. It's been able to conduct some real-world studies on how the vaccine performs, but no criticism of the way in which it has prevented Palestinians from accessing those vaccines for so long. And again, part of that is to do with this media blackout.
Yeah, I like you tying these together, because it really does highlight kind of for me what it means to be a socialist and to have a socialist analysis, which is Israel has a fantastic public health program, but is also a highly inegalitarian and racist country, right? And socialists, we operate by what Eugene Debs his motto was, which is, while there's a lower class, I am in it, and while there's a soul in prison, I'm not free. So it doesn't matter if there's a fantastic public health program if millions of people are excluded from it, right? So we can take, for example, lessons on how to run a government health program from Israel. But if we are serious egalitarians, we have to also be committed to universal access, to making sure that people aren't discriminated against because they're Palestinian, right? So a socialist is an economic egalitarian who believes in a strong public sector that is democratically run. But a socialist is also an anti-racist who believes that people shouldn't be deprived of vaccines because they are in a group that is considered non-people for the purposes of citizenship rights.
Nathan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website for Current Affairs where people can read your works.
Yeah. Go to currentaffairs.org. We have a print magazine that is very, very beautiful. And I recommend everyone subscribe. And my book, as you say, is Why You Should Be a Socialist.
I will link to Current Affairs from our website. Thanks so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thanks very much.
My guest has been Nathan Robinson, editor of Current Affairs and up until recently a columnist for The Guardian. His book, which is just out in paperback, is called Why You Should Be a Socialist. His work has also appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, The New Republic, The Nation, and elsewhere. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.